this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us on the WPR News Network. We're talking about wildlife today with David Drake and Jamie Knack. David is a UW Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor. Jamie is an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. Join in the conversation by calling 800-642-1234, or you can always email talk@wpr.org. Jamie, David, thanks for coming in today.
Hey, thanks for having us.
You bet. Okay, so armadillos are on the march.
Yeah.
Yes. What's going on? I hear they're headed towards the border.
They're coming for us. So there's been a number of sightings in Iowa, which has really triggered some press to pick up these sightings. So each year, Iowa, the last couple of years, have been getting about a dozen to two dozen reports of armadillo sightings in the state. And so that's prompted the question, are armadillos moving north, and will Wisconsin see armadillos at some point in time? But it likely has, you know, a connection with climate change and the warmer temperatures, because it is the cold winters, the frozen ground, that limit the distribution of armadillos north. And the species that we're talking about is the nine-banded armadillo. They don't always have nine bands, somewhere between 7 and 11, but they're called the nine-banded armadillo. And they're the only one that's found in North America. Worldwide, there's about 20, 21 species of armadillos. They're native to South America. And so their life history, their habitat needs, they're usually in moist forests, tropical forests in South America. So here we'll often find them in Oklahoma and Texas and Kansas and Louisiana, but they have been reported in states like Iowa and Illinois and Nebraska. So the question is, how are they getting there? Are they actually moving on their own, or are they hitching a ride and stowaways in transportation? So whether that's a fruit or a produce truck, or, you know, some means that way, or people are taking them with to bring them back, which we highly
don't do that.
they can be a very invasive species because of the holes that they dig. And again, they're pursuing insects. They're primarily nocturnal, and they have some other interesting characteristics. They can jump straight up like 4 feet. And so they don't, when they're alarmed, or it's like a predator aversion tactic, but that doesn't bode well if you're driving a car. And instead of them just scooting underneath the car, they often get caught in the undercarriage. Oh. So you see in the southeastern part of the U.S. a fair amount of armadillo mortality on the roads, and that can be a issue for them.
And that's the that's the joke, is that the armadillo habitat is the center stripe of the road.
Oh, golly.
Yeah. Yeah. And another really interesting, fascinating thing for me was in terms of the life history of the armadillo, is that the female produces just a single egg that gets fertilized, and then that egg splits, and then each of those split again, so that the young that are born are 4 identical genetically young. So always 4 young, always genetically identical. And it's interesting because evolutionarily, that's not really to their advantage. It doesn't give a lot of diversity, genetic diversity for the population. Mm-hmm. So,
but they've managed to survive, obviously.
Yeah, right?
If they do get, you know, to Wisconsin, what kind of problems are they going to cause? You talked about holes. Are there anything else?
Well, I should say too, they're not necessarily always problems.
Okay.
So the holes or the burrows can also be used by other species that don't dig their own burrow, and they do control insects or eat insects. The issue is they're not native to this area. And I think, you know, even in Iowa with all of these sightings, the state is still not developing like a management plan. We don't necessarily have evidence of a breeding population. We're not at that point. But another 20, 30, 100 years of climate change, that range shift could be much more
pronounced.
Further north. Yeah. And we could have armadillos here.
Is it similar to like possums, because they've kind of made their way up too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So they're relatively same size as a possum, and possums are above their historic range up here in the northern part of the United States, and because possums, they're not acclimated for this cold temperature in the wintertime, so they don't have fur on their ears and they don't have fur on their tails. And so for a possum that's been up here for a while, a lot of times, and possums are active year-round, so if they come through a hard winter, a lot of times they'll have frostbite in their tail and ears, and that tissue actually freeze and die and fall off of the body. And so you'll see ears that are notched and shortened, and tails that are shortened as well. And so that's the consequence of expanding your range north.
Yes, the settlers are coming.
That's right.
As far as the climate change, with our milder winters and earlier springs, are there any other besides the two we talked about that are kind of working their way in?
Yeah, so not necessarily working their, well, some for sure working their way in, but there are other examples of range shifts. And so a lot of times, the species that are going to be most affected by climate change are already at the edge of their range. So another example for our state would be snowshoe hares. Their range is slowly shifting further north and out of Wisconsin. There still will be in Wisconsin, but it's moving further north in the state. And if you think about snowshoe hares, they change their coat color in the winter. And with less snowfall, or snowfall that doesn't occur until January, and the transition of the fur coat has to do with day length and, is triggered in a different way, not just because it snows, it doesn't trigger their coat to change color. And so there's a phenotypic mismatch between the coat color of the hare, a white colored hare, on a brown landscape that makes them more susceptible to predation and so on. And so we are seeing through research that's being done in our department that shift is occurring in Wisconsin. And there still are some ways, though, that we can mitigate that. So through habitat management, having younger forests, thicker cover, so thicker habitat for those snowshoe hares that are white to hide out in, they may be less prone to predation than more open forested habitats. And so those are, just examples. There's a number of wonderful case studies on wildlife species and what that climate change adaptation might look like and how we can help mitigate some of that.
Yeah, northern cardinal is another one that is pushing its, range north, further north than historically. And then that's really it for wildlife, but there's a lot of plants that are being affected by the climate change and the range shifts. And obviously here in Wisconsin, we have the tension zone that goes from the northwestern part of the state to the southeastern part of the state. And so that is the northern part of the southern species, is the northern edge of the southern species, and then the southern edge of the northern species. And so we're seeing those plants shift further north as climate is changing as well.
Now, how is that tracked? Someone's out there checking how far they've seen a species?
Yep, that's exactly what's happening. So both through citizen science as well as people who are researchers and scientists are monitoring those shifts and monitoring species distributions and presence, absence, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we've talked about the breeding bird survey that's done in the breeding time in the spring, summer, and then also the backyard bird counts. And those are, again, citizen-driven programs. Yep. But also biologists are doing surveys for a lot of species as well. And that is what we can look at trend data over time to mark those changes.
Yeah. That is important, the over time.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, we've got a call from Margaret in Madison who has something to say about armadillos. Oh. Go ahead, Margaret.
Hey, I was so interested in hearing your talk about armadillos. I live in Wisconsin, but a number of years I was in southwest Missouri, and I go down there occasionally. And this is an area south of Springfield, which is in the southwest part of the state. And about between 20 and 30 years ago, we started seeing dead armadillos, and it's just increased. Every time I go down there, I start counting them. I've never seen a live one. They're usually, poor things are usually legs up on the road. And so then, but prior to that, there was a lot of skunks down there. Well, I haven't smelled a skunk in years. I don't know. I think the skunks moved out, and then at some point the armadillos moved in. And then the other interesting creature is that there was a population of white squirrels. And this town is Marionville, Missouri, and there was a lot of them for years. they moved out, but then a few years back, someone kind of reestablished, and so there are still a few hanging out. But anyway, just my comment, observation of those three species.
Yeah, so a couple of two things that we'll talk about the white squirrels, and we'll talk a little bit about the armadillos. But again, with them being an invasive species, they didn't evolve with a lot of predators with that armored shell that they have. And there may be, in some cases, some interplay between striped skunks and armadillos in terms of sharing the same habitat, eating the same food sources, and so on. So who knows? But your local or the folks there could probably give you a better answer in terms of why we're seeing an increase, or if there is an increase in trend of armadillos in that area, that state. And then the white squirrels, so we were talking a little bit about genetics and diversity, but our gray squirrel that we have in Wisconsin also is sometimes white, or it could be completely black, and that's a genetic feature where either they're albino or some form of albinism where they lack pigment, or have too much pigmentation, and then they're melanistic. You're seeing the same things with those white squirrels as well, and it's a genetic condition, recessive genes being passed in that local population. And so over time, you know, nature would lend itself, just like we were talking about the snowshoe hare, white squirrel sticks out pretty good for predators, and so they would typically not survive as well as the more camouflage color of a gray squirrel. And so over time, they would weed themselves out. But in an area, in a neighborhood or places where there isn't necessarily that pressure, you may see that sustain in the population. So,
okay. And did you want to say something about the armadillos again, or was that?
I think she was mentioning about the skunks. Is that the skunk population she hasn't noticed? But, you know, the skunk population should still be around. Mm-hmm. And obviously they're nocturnal, so you may not notice that they're there unless they are being smelled or being hit or have emitted their scent to protect themselves from a predator. So I suspect that the skunk population is probably doing okay there. And as a matter of fact, as Jamie mentioned, the skunk population may even benefit from the armadillos, because armadillos do create burrows. And skunks are one of those species that don't burrow themselves, but they will occupy a burrow that's already been created, for example, by armadillos. So it's very, very possible that skunks are doing just fine, and you just may not be aware of it.
Okay. Well, thank you, Margaret. We really appreciate that observation. We're talking about wildlife with David Drake, a UW Extension wildlife specialist and professor, and Jamie Knack, a UW Extension senior wildlife outreach specialist, and they're both affiliated with the Division of Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Do you have questions for them? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. And I hope you can stay with us today, because coming up at 12:30, we'll talk to the author of Restoring Prairie Woods and Pond, How a Small Trail Can Make a Big Difference. Lori Lawler will join us to talk about a trail building project in Eagle, Wisconsin. It's really nice book. So we look forward to talking with her. But right now, let's go back to the phones, because we have more questions. Tom in Green Bay, go right ahead.
Hi there. There are some old records for armadillo in Wisconsin. In the mid-1980s, we obtained a specimen down at Greenleaf, south of Green Bay, at a truck stop in the middle of winter that had been stomped on. That made the Press Gazette in Green Bay, and I got a phone call from a lady in Suamico who had one mounted in her living room. And that one had been picked up at Suamico. It was a roadkill. It was picked up by her brother. And I do a lot of work on the for the Forest Service, and I was told of another specimen up at Long Lake up in Florence County that was also a roadkill. And that one, unfortunately, was lost when their freezer failed. from Greenleaf is at the Richter Museum at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, the remains of it. Other comments, your snowshoe hare decline, if you take a look at the data, it coincides with the explosion of Fisher in northern Wisconsin in the late 1980s. And basically the snowshoe hare population, which was weakly cyclic, flatlined ever since the late 1980s. two other species you might look at for a rapid expansion northward of the southern flying squirrel, which has totally displaced the northern and is now all the way up to Lake Superior, and white-footed deer mouse, the carrier of the ticks for Lyme disease, is all the way up to Lake Superior and even Isle Royal. So a lot of species are moving northward very fast.
Okay. Well, thank you, Tom, for all those observations.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. Yeah. There definitely has been, and we didn't get a chance to say that, but there has been sightings of armadillos in the state. I suspect most of them are road mortality, and we can question, you know, where they're coming from.
Yep.
But similar to Iowa, you know, it's something to be monitoring, and it's not to say they couldn't establish in a century from now.
Yeah. Yep. You never know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and those other species Tom mentioned, the southern flying squirrel. So that's a species that historically their range is here in Wisconsin. So, you know, the species we've been talking about, like the possum and the cardinal, those species have actually moved in Wisconsin, have not historically always been here like the southern flying squirrel or the white-footed mouse has.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but those are good observations as well.
Okay, great. Thank you. Dan in Valders, what can we help you with?
Yeah, I used to live in Florida and in Texas, and we had terrible fire ants there.
Oh.
And I knew they came up from Mexico, and they can't live where it freezes hard. So I wondered how far north they've come, and if we can stop them from getting to Wisconsin before they come and kill all the ground nesting birds and ground dwelling, you know, skunks and things.
Yeah, I still have scars on my ankles while I was in graduate school at Texas A&M from fire ants, and they are no joke. I'm not sure what their range is, how far north they are yet, but next time PJ Leish is on, he'd be a good person to ask about that. But I suspect that, you know, that they are also a South American species, and I suspect that they are going to be pretty sensitive to cold weather. So it probably will be a while before they come up here, and hopefully they never get up here.
And just as an FYI, PJ is going to be on with us Wednesday, the 21st of August.
Yeah, that'd be a good question for him.
Yeah. So, Joel, write that down. Okay. Thank you, Dan. Next up, we've got Craig in Merrimack. Go ahead, Craig.
Good morning. I've been on Lake Wisconsin for the last 47 years, and I've noticed in the last 5 years that Canada geese have started nesting on Lake Wisconsin. That was, of course, they're not necessarily great neighbors, but they started nesting on Lake Wisconsin. And also, I've noticed that they winter over on the Wisconsin River below the dam. So I've seen them in the winter on those sand on those islands there below the dam and stacked. I wonder if you have any comments on that.
Yeah, well, Canada geese have been in the state of Wisconsin forever, and probably have been nesting in Lake Wisconsin for a much longer period of time than perhaps you've noticed the last 5 years. So they're relatively common. The species you're talking about they're a Canada goose, but we would refer to them as a resident species because typically migratory Canada geese would be nesting up in the tundra of Canada this time of the year, not necessarily in Wisconsin. So the birds that you're seeing nesting are resident. They're here year-round, and that's also why you see them in the wintertime, and they're probably down at that section of the dam because you have open water down there that they can inhabit. But resident Canada geese have been, at least in the eastern part of the United States, around since at least the 1950s. So that is not necessarily a new problem, although it sounds like maybe that's a new observation for you.
Yeah, there's a lot of communities that have a little bit of a problem with the Canada geese.
Yes, absolutely. And there are very good management solutions for resident Canada geese, mm-hmm. depending on what the problem is. Usually it's nesting and the aggression that comes with the localized nests from the mating pair. It's also a lot of feces that's being dropped on athletic playing fields, sidewalks, things like that. So there are some very good solutions that can be put in place if you are having issues at your specific location. And you're welcome to reach out to us, and we're happy to put you in touch with those solutions.
Okay, that sounds like a good idea. Let's talk a little bit about coyote cams.
Yeah, this is pretty cool.
Yeah, tell us about it.
Yeah, so I've got a friend and a colleague of mine Michael Cole, Dr. Michael Cole, who's a wildlife ecologist at the University of Georgia, and he's been studying urban coyotes in Atlanta for the last few years. And so they trap coyotes in the city of Atlanta and put radio collars on them, but these radio collars also have a camera attached to them. And so they just have now started to release some of the camera footage on their Facebook page for their project, and maybe we can link that Facebook page on Larry's show here. But it's super cool. You know, it's a very unique, interesting perspective when you start looking at these videos, because you see the side of the nose of the coyote a lot of times, or the whiskers, and you know, and you're maybe 2 feet off the ground type thing. But it's just cool to see where they go, and you know, there's a video there, blurb, where the coyote's just hanging out overlooking an interstate freeway in Atlanta, for example, and another one where they're walking through a big parking lot. So you see that they're in these very, very urbanized areas, and it's just neat to see where they are. And most of the time, most of the videos are at night when they're active. The daytime videos are the animals are usually just resting and laying down, hanging out. But it's just cool to see what that coyote sees and where they are and things like that. And you can obviously figure out the spatial location based on the radio collar, but you don't always get that visual perspective. And that's what's really unique about this project.
Is that given the researchers new information about how they're adapting to their area?
Yeah, it's a little bit about the adaptation, although coyotes have been in urban areas for decades now, you know, throughout the United States. But what is really interesting is to just see some of the interactions they're having with their pack mates. You see some of the coyote pups on there, but you also see, I didn't see this on their videos, but you would have the potential to see interactions with other species, including human beings, pets, domestic pets, but, you know, raccoons and other species of wildlife that that these animals are coming in contact with.
Now, you've been involved in the UW Urban Canid project for a while, studying coyotes and red foxes, right, in the Wisconsin or Madison area. How is that going right now? Are you still active? What's going on?
Yep, we're still active. That's how I met Michael, is because we've got similar interests. You know, we've got this urban canid project going on up in Madison, where we've, since 2014, have been radio collaring coyotes and red fox in the Madison area. And now we're just kind of shifting over to red fox. We are not learning necessarily anything new about coyotes that either we haven't figured out or other researchers that doing urban coyote work haven't figured out. So, but there's a lot of interesting questions about red fox, so we're tending to concentrate more on red fox. And we'll be trapping again this winter, and we would encourage anybody listening to look at our Facebook page. It's an open Facebook page. If you just Google UW Urban Canid Project in Facebook, you'll find us. But we are going to invite the public to come out trapping with us this winter, as we have done for many winters before, especially before COVID. But this winter in particular, we really want the public to come out with us. I've got a new graduate student on the project. And what we are going to look at is if, as people come out with us to go trapping and see these animals, does that experience change people's opinion, knowledge, attitudes about not only trapping, but about coyotes and red fox in general? And so we're going to have you, if you come out with us, we're going to have you complete a pre-survey. We're going to have you come out with us, and we're going to have you conduct complete a post-survey, and we're going to see if we're making any difference in people's knowledge and opinions and attitudes towards both trapping and these urban canid species.
Okay. So when you're talking about trapping, you're going to be trapping them alive?
Yep, we live trap.
Okay.
We live trap because dead coyotes don't move very far with radio collars, so or dead fox. So no, we live trap them, put a radio collar on them, and then we release them at the spot where we trap them. You know, we are very transparent about what we do, and that's one of the reasons we invite the public to come out with us, so they can see what's going on. And over the years, there's been great public interest in this project, so we'd love to share that with people.
Yeah, for sure. I know that a lot of times people are afraid when they see the coyotes or the red fox. Should they have a fear? What are they doing? Are they hurting us any?
Yeah, it's probably context specific. So generally, the answer to that is no. They should not have a fear of either coyotes or red fox. However, if you start seeing, especially a coyote during the daytime, if it's getting relatively close to people, either in cars or as you're out walking or jogging or in your yard, And that coyote doesn't show a fear of human beings, meaning it doesn't move away from you when you start to maybe haze it or to try to scare it off. Then we'd want to notify the police or the local county biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, just to alert them that there's a coyote that's starting to habituate or getting used to people and losing its fear of human beings. Because what tends to happen is when those animals habituate, then not to say this always happens, but the next step in the process is that they may start getting a little bit more bold and coming closer to our neighborhoods and our houses, and then there might be occasionally pet attacks and things like that by coyotes, and that's what we want to avoid. You know, most of the time the coyotes are out active primarily at nighttime, and it's not to say if you see a coyote during the day you should be alarmed. You just monitor that animal and understand what's normal behavior and not normal behavior. But most of the time for both coyotes and red fox, we encourage people to just watch that animal from a safe distance, enjoy seeing the animal, because it is a really cool experience to see them, especially in urbanized landscapes. Mm-hmm. And then haze that animal, so scare it. And the proper response from the animal, both coyotes and red fox, is that they should move away from you. So they may not necessarily run from you, but they should turn and at least walk away from you. And that's, we want to maintain that fear of humans in these animals, and that will kind of promote this positive coexistence.
And that means do not feed.
Do not feed them directly or indirectly.
The other big thing we can do is eliminate food sources.
Yeah,
and so not putting your garbage out the night before, cleaning up spilled bird seed that attracts small mammals that then attract
predators.
Mesopredators. Mm-hmm. Yep. If you feed your dogs outside, you know, cleaning up any uneaten dog food, yep, things like that, just keep it nice and tidy, and that'll help not attract coyotes and fox, but also a whole lot of other problem species.
For sure.
Definitely.
Yeah, most people are primarily concerned about coyotes. So if you have coyotes around, again, they're around. You may not be aware of it, but they are around in just about every city in North America. So if you have dogs and you're out, especially at night, you know, make sure your dog is on a leash and you can control your dog. And that would be very helpful. You know, we have an iNaturalist page for our project, so report sightings of coyotes and red fox, and that helps us monitor where these animals are in the landscape. And for the most part, for the fox, because they are in closer proximity to human beings, we're more used to seeing them. And so I think we have a more positive affinity for fox than we do for coyotes. And, and fox aren't as large, so they don't seem as imposing or as threatening. Although fox will tend to occasionally get a backyard chicken once in a while for dinner. So,
yes.
Yeah. But, yeah. So,
it's nature, folks.
It is nature.
And we're talking about wildlife and nature today. If you've got a question for Jamie or David, please give us a call. Lines are open, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. So we did have a caller in Madison say that they saw a coyote in the city and believe it was wearing a radio collar.
That would be one of ours.
Uh-huh.
Yep. So depending on what part of the city they saw him in, we probably could tell you where we trapped that animal.
Ah, very neat.
Yeah.
How long do those collars last?
Well, they stay on the animal for the life of the animal, but typically the battery lasts only a year. Mm. If we get 2 years out of it, we're doing very, very well.
Yeah.
But not long enough, given the expense of the collar and how much work we have to go to actually get the collar on the animal.
Sure. Have you recaptured them? Mm-hmm. And can you add, put new fresh batteries in then?
Yeah, we don't do that because the way the collar is built, but we would put a brand new collar on the animal. And we've done that for a number of both fox and coyotes. Mm-hmm.
Great. And then we did get another one. John in Madison called to ask if cougars are in Wisconsin. He said he's heard of sole male cougars coming here from out west. Jeannie?
Yeah. So, yes, we have had mountain lions or cougars, same animal, different terms, documented in the state. And that's going back a couple decades now. So the animals that have been detected, whether that most commonly it's through a trail camera that then that person contacts the local wildlife biologist and they can come out and take measurements of looking at that photo, or if there's other animals that they've got photos of, like a deer or a coyote, they can make comparisons and verify that it in fact is a mountain lion or a cougar. Also, tracks can be verified. In some cases, we've had scat or blood or hair, different other genetic pieces. When there's been genetic material, where we've been able to look at it, they have all come back from the South Dakota's Black Hills population of cougars, and they have been young males, which makes sense. They're dispersing. And so we've definitely tracked mountain lions and cougars through the state. I think the Department of Natural Resources likely maintains a page devoted to cougar sightings because it's a pretty common question. But we have not had a female documented as of yet, and no documentation of a breeding population. So they're not considered a, you know, managed animal in the state. They are a protected yeah. species. So
what other large cats do we have here?
Yep. So occasionally we have lynx in the state, and they would be coming down from Canada. So occasionally those are sighted, or road mortality where we're able to verify it. But bobcats would be the main felid in Wisconsin that we have.
And there's quite a few.
Then they're primarily northern and central forests, but there certainly are sightings in the southern, more sightings in the southern part of the state too. Some question is, you know, are those Iowa bobcats coming up or are those, you know, northern bobcats moving down?
So, sure. Yeah. Fun. Tom in Hayward has a question. Go ahead, Tom.
Excuse me. I have not heard since 1981 a meadowlark. I grew up in an area just south of Highway 8 where, as a kid, I heard them all the time. And I have not heard a meadowlark in years. And I just wondered what happened to them.
So Tom, I can speak to this. My graduate research was actually on grassland birds in southwestern Wisconsin, and meadowlarks were certainly one of the species that I had studied, and that was in the early 2000s. I still do see meadowlarks, and I always smile when I do. They're noticeable as they flush, and you see the coloring on their tails, and certainly their song is very recognizable. But the western meadowlark, we reached the eastern edge of its range. And so we've never had a lot of western meadowlarks, but certainly eastern meadowlarks. The issue really comes down to habitat loss and fragmentation, as grassland habitat as a whole has been declining for the last 50 years. And so that's a big part of it. And I'd have to look further into the breeding bird survey data to look at how meadowlarks specifically are trending, but they certainly have been declining because of habitat.
Yeah, yep. But here, I'll give you my best meadowlark imitation, since you haven't heard one since 1981.
Oh, no.
Spring of the year.
That didn't sound like a bird.
No,
to
it's
me.
Not.
Yeah, they're pretty unmistakable.
They are. And they're super really cool. Pretty. The way they fly is really noticeable as well. Yeah, neat birds.
I take my dog to a dog park near my home, and there are a number of meadowlarks there in a nice area. Yeah. And they're out there eating the mosquitoes, thank goodness, and dragonflies. Yeah. I saw a flock of dragonflies. Yeah. Never seen that before.
Yeah.
But there's so many mosquitoes.
Yeah,
so.
I know.
Yes. Definitely. Yeah. If you've got a call or a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. All those lines are open. So let's talk a little bit about some of the DNR surveys that are going on. We've got two wildlife surveys going on that they really want the public to participate in. Tell us about the Operation Deer Watch.
Yeah, so these are opportunities for community science, and you may start to hear a shift depending on the program and their history, and, you know, but we're really talking about what do we name these types of programs? Because we are finding in some cases citizen science is not a very inclusive term when we think about, you know, you don't need to have citizenship in order to contribute.
Oh,
so you could be traveling from another country or to volunteer. So you may see more terms like community science or participatory science. And it's all kind of in that bubble of
that really rolls off
science.
The tongue. Participatory science.
I know, right? It's a lot. So anyway, basically the Department of Natural Resources and many other organizations too are looking for volunteers to report data that can then help with looking at population levels, indexes, trends over time for both deer and for game birds in this case. And so for the Operation Deer Watch that runs started August 1st, it's for the month of August and September. And the goal is to measure the reproductive status of deer, basically a fawn to doe ratio. But they also ask you to record the number of bucks and things like that. And so there is a app that you download on your phone, and it's pretty self-explanatory. Then it's just entering that information, and then there's of course guidelines in terms of how you report and what you report. So you're reporting from dawn to dusk, you're reporting all the deer you see, not just fawns and does. And then they don't want you to include multiple observations, so of the same observation. So if you live in an area and around dusk, you take the kids for a ride and you go around the block or in your neighborhoods and you're recording deer, you don't want to do that every day because you're probably going to be getting the same family groups there. So, and you can't count your trail camera observations. So that has to be with your own eyes. And then similarly, same thing, there's an app that can be downloaded. And if you go to the Department of Natural Resources website and just type in Game Brood Survey or Operation Deer Watch, it'll point you right to it. The Game Bird Surveys, those are looking at rough grouse and ringneck pheasant and wild turkeys, and looking at brood survival. So how many hens are you seeing and how many poults? And that gives us an indication of what reproduction look like. Mm-hmm. And it's just one piece of information that goes into models and compare different scenarios to decide, you know, what that hunting season and looks like the following fall, and how these birds and deer are doing. So it's a great opportunity. I did want to say as well, there's a ton. Wisconsin has a ton of ways that you can do community science, yeah. And so it's not just hunted species, but there's also water action volunteers and the Bumblebee Brigade, Snapshot Wisconsin, so many different things. And so one website that houses not just the Department of Natural Resources programs, but a collection of all of them, including some work that UW Extension does, is called Who's Who of Citizen-Based Monitoring in Wisconsin. And again, if you just type that in, then you can actually search by subject, you can search by your county and see what types of programs you can contribute to. And I'd really encourage you to get children involved.
Great
it's
idea.
It's really a fun thing. And yep. They can do all the work on the apps and the smartphones, and but it's a really great way to engage them and let them know how much their efforts are appreciated and how it's used.
Yeah, and there's a bunch of other opportunities. So iNaturalist is another one where mm-hmm. you have project-specific pages under that iNaturalist umbrella, and you can report on just a gob of stuff from uh-huh. astrology to geology to, you know, water, plants, weather.
You mean astronomy?
Astronomy. Yes, astronomy. Not astrology. Astronomy, excuse
Neptune
me.
Neptune is in, you know.
It's rising. It's yeah. So, exactly.
That's right, folks. He's a scientist.
Stick to your lane.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick little break here, but I believe that our wonderful technical director, Lee Rayburn, found a meadowlark sound. So let's hear that. Is that right?
It was just like what I sounded like. I don't know why he needed to do that.
Sounded just like you. One more time.
Spring of the year.
Okay. Oh, we're not going to get it back again. All right, that's fine. But maybe we'll have it again when we come back. But we're talking about wildlife with Jamie Knack and David Drake. Jamie is a UW Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, and David is an Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor. And we'd like to hear from you. Lines are filling up right now, but you still have a chance. 800-642-1234. And we'll be back in just a bit.
Tomorrow on The Larry Mueller Show, we talk about home improvement with our expert, John Freiberger, and we're going to talk about getting water out of flooded basements, because goodness knows we've had a lot of that lately. And then another water-related topic, but more fun one, we're going to talk about how to stay safe while boating. That's tomorrow right here on WPR News. Right now, we're taking questions about wildlife, and we're going to go right to the phones. We have Linda in Platteville. Hi, Linda. What's your question?
I have a three fawn and a doe in my backyard almost all the time, night and day. They lay around, they poop, they drink out of the bird bath. And then I want my grandchildren to play in the lawn. So are they in any danger of prions or whatever else deer could carry?
Yeah, thank you for the question. And the reference to prions is relating to chronic wasting disease, which is a prion-related disease that attacks wild cervid, like elk and deer. So generally, no. So there's been no evidence in either the medical literature or the scientific literature about chronic wasting disease passing between deer and human beings. And typically, the concern would be if you harvest a deer and that deer has tested positive for chronic wasting disease and you've consumed some of the meat. So far, thankfully and hopefully never, there has not been any evidence that chronic wasting disease is jumping species lines from deer to human beings. So it's unlikely that you have to worry about that in your yard, even if the deer are defecating in the yard. So I wouldn't worry about that. One thing you might want to just be concerned about is that if the kids are out playing, that they're not harassing the deer. But other than that, this is a great learning moment and a wonderful time to take your kids outside and see some incredible Wisconsin wildlife.
Have you heard a lot of reports with does having 2-3 fawns this year?
We've got two. Where I live in Columbia County, we have two does that each have 3 fawns. It's been pretty cool. Yeah. So, you know, and that can be a really good indication of habitat quality as well and body condition. Yep. We have had a little lighter winter this past winter.
Yeah.
It's certainly possible. We actually have a fetus in the department that has 5 fawns in it. But that did not come to full term. So I'm not sure, you know, if that doe would have actually gave birth to all 5 or, you know, what would have happened. But yeah, there's some pretty remarkable records.
Yep.
Wow. It's amazing. Thank you, Linda. Dick in Brooklyn, go right ahead with your question. Dick, are you there?
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yes, this is Dick. So my question is to what extent would coyotes attack young calves out there? And let me preface that by saying about 2 years ago, went out to check cattle at night. A cow had just had a calf. About 50 yards up the field, there was with my spotlight, there was a coyote kind of sitting there watching, which obviously bolted when I did that. But my question is, with the number of coyotes around, is there a possibility, probability that they would attack young calves?
Yeah, Dick, it probably depends on where you are in the state to some extent. It depends on a bunch of other circumstances. But typically, yes, coyotes do attack livestock. They attack goats, sheep, you know, they will attack calves, things like that. But typically in the southern part of the state, that there's enough food for coyotes here that they probably don't need to expend the energy and risk getting, you know, kicked in the head by the mom cow or try to chase the calf, even unless the calf is down. Coyotes are super opportunistic. So if the calf is down and can't get up, and there's a free meal there and the coyote's hungry, absolutely, they probably would predate the calf. But generally, probably not. But again, there's other cultural practices where maybe when the cows are calving, that you would keep those cows and the calves closer to the barn or closer to the house, for example. Maybe you'd have spotlights, motion sensor spotlights, so pointing outward so that if a coyote comes around, that spotlight goes on, and that might be enough to scare them out of the area. If you have dogs that you can leave out, that's another good protection strategy. So there are strategies that you can employ to at least reduce, if not eliminate, coyote predation if it's occurring or if that's a concern.
Okay, thanks for that call. We got an email from Randy in northern Minnesota, and he said there seems to be an explosion of wild turkeys throughout the upper Midwest, and he's wondering, what is the cause of the increase?
So turkey populations have been increasing over the last, when did we do reintroductions?
Decades.
Decades, yeah. For sure. And they have responded well to maturing of forests. And certainly we had a very good crop, mast crop this last fall. So having, really good quality habitat can help. So their populations certainly have both increased in number, but also expanded. There was a time when turkeys were reintroduced in Wisconsin that we didn't think they'd go much further north than maybe half the state or so. And I think we have turkeys in every county. But in terms of their population, I would have to look into the survey data, the department's data for Minnesota to look at how their turkey population is trending. But you can look at that in Wisconsin. You can go to the Department of Natural Resources website and type in wildlife surveys. And all these surveys we've been talking about, you can see the report and what that trend data looks like. So they'll have the years across the bottom axis, and you can look at what the population levels look like based on. So for turkeys, they would have harvest data, both spring and fall. And then they would have the brood survey data as well.
But in terms of the explosion that he was referencing, so turkey populations and turkey recruitment of the young into the population can be variable from year to year, and it can be dictated a little bit by the previous year's habitat conditions that Jamie was talking about, but also weather conditions. And this year, we've had a relatively mild winter, and we had a relatively warm spring. And so it's likely that the poults, the young turkeys that hatched out of the eggs, they probably didn't suffer much mortality, relatively speaking, from hyperthermia and poor weather this year, because we had a relatively warm spring. And so there's probably pretty decent survival of the poults into the adult population. And that might be what's accounting for that explosion, as he was talking about, that where he's seeing more turkeys this year than perhaps in previous years.
Let's go to Rick in Portage County. Hi, Rick. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We have a very isolated, about a 15-acre lake, completely surrounded by woods on our land. And about 6 years ago, we started having a pair of trumpeter swans come in and land and stay about a week to 2 weeks and then leave. And I actually had an opportunity to go out and call them in and swim with them one time.
Oh.
15 feet away, actually. Very curious birds. But my question is, 2 years now in a row, we've had them stay all summer. I haven't been able to spot any little ones. But I'm wondering, is it uncommon for them to stay all year in this part of the state, or is it climate-induced? Or anyway, thank you.
Yeah, typically they – so usually it's in Portage County, so kind of south central. It's probably not terribly common to have them stick around the whole summer like that. You know, we usually see them – down in the southern part of the state more in the fall and the spring as they're migrating through, or maybe not even see them. We might hear them just kind of honking at night as they're passing overhead. So it might be a little unusual, but enjoy it. And the one note of caution I will give to you is be careful about swimming around them, because if they have cygnets, they can be very, very protective and defensive. And in past times, for example, with Canada geese, when they will swim dogs to chase geese off of properties, if there's not a person out there accompanying that dog, geese will drown the dog. And swans are large enough that even if you're a good swimmer, they could probably put you into some distress. So if you want to go swimming, do that. But I would keep a healthy distance from the swans as you swim.
Wow, I never realized that could happen to a dog.
it's terribly unfortunate.
Oh, my gosh.
And hopefully that won't happen to anybody.
Yes, right. So trumpeter swans, I didn't hear about trumpeter swans being in the state for maybe like since the last 10 years or so. Is that been an increase?
Yeah, they're a conservation success story, yep, too, with building their populations back up. They certainly, one of the issues with swans is competition. They get out-competed by mute swans, invasive species. So there's been a lot of work in the state. to remove mute swans so that trumpeter swans can thrive. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the specifics again on swans and the interbreeding, or the, I would say, smaller lakes and in Portage where he's talking about, that'd be interesting to look up a little bit more
and, it would be.
And see what that seems like a small size lake to me, mm-hmm. For that big bird, but they are territorial and just one pair would be all they would expect to support there.
Yeah. Sure. Great. All right. Well, thank you for that call or that email. Actually, that was a call. We'll be back real quick after the news. So stick with us. This is a Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and we're back with David Drake, UW Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor, and Jamie Knack, a UW Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. And we've got a bunch of phone calls waiting, so we're going to pop over them right away. Karen in Marshfield, you had something to add about trumpeter swans. Go right ahead.
Yeah, we've had a pair for 3 years now on the pond across the street, and they have two little cygnets this year.
Yeah, it's very nice.
Definitely fun to watch. Mm-hmm. Oh, neat.
Is that normal for two?
Yeah,
definitely. Have, similar to sandhill cranes, you may have some siblicide, sibling rivalry. One makes it, one doesn't. Yeah. But not uncommon.
Yeah, or get killed by predation or weather or just a bad year for feeding or whatever the case is.
So an heir and a spare.
Yeah, so right.
Okay, let's switch topics a little bit. Barbara in Madison has a question. Go ahead, Barbara.
Hi. Over the last 8 years or so, I've fostered monarchs in my aquarium with my grandchildren, and it's been a wonderful experience setting them free and watching them metamorphosize. But this year I have only seen one monarch in my yard. Usually I have many fostered by now. Does the mosquito removal pesticides affect them? Or
that's a loaded question there.
So Barbara, I'm going to just right away, I really don't have the background in monarchs. I don't know that David does either. suffice it to say, though, there are a number of monarch-related organizations that you're probably aware of, and I think those would be really good sources of information to find out where the current population is at. I know that there's a lot of research being done on insecticides and their impacts. I also know there's been a number of citizen, I don't want to say citizen, community opportunities, community science opportunities to go monarch tagging, which you may be aware of as well. I know Horicon National Wildlife Refuge usually has one. And I believe those programs are August, September, right before migration.
Yeah.
So take a look a little bit about some of those programs you might be able to participate in, and those folks would surely be able to answer that question better than I.
Yeah, definitely. Wildlife and insects are two different topics.
Yeah, we try to work with everything that's got a backbone, but the other side of it, though, is that the public or you and I have very different definitions of what is wildlife. Mm-hmm. And so even when you major in wildlife ecology at UW-Madison, we cover birds, mammals, reptiles, and amphibians. We don't really focus on fish. So that's the ichthyology major, and not one that we have in our department. So we focus on those four taxa.
But it's been great to see. There's been a tremendous amount of interest amongst the public for pollinator species. You know, bees, butterflies, and a wide range of everything else that pollinates. And so, a lot of the management recommendations we might put into place for habitat that benefit birds certainly benefit a lot of the pollinators. So we're not entomologists, and we don't do a lot with pollinator species, but we certainly are aware that people are interested in that, and we try to incorporate that into some of our programming when we can.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And just a reminder, PJ Leash, who is an entomologist, he'll be with us on the 21st. So, you know, I'm sure he'd be happy to talk to you about monarchs and all the other little things that fly and crawl.
Yeah.
And also on Friday, I'll be talking to the author of a book on bird-friendly gardening.
Oh,
so
excellent.
If anybody's interested in that, that would be a good time to ask questions of her as well. So emails, Sandra from the southwest side of Madison emailed to say that earlier this spring they had a woodchuck on their deck. Luckily, not under it like mine. Sandra wants to know if woodchucks are common in her area, which is slightly wooded, as retention ponds nearby and has retention ponds nearby.
Yes, so a woodchuck, also called groundhog, so the same animal. They are very, very common. They're fossorial, so they live under the ground. They live in a burrow system. And they are true hibernators. So from about November till March or so, you really don't see them up above the ground because they're sleeping in their burrow. But yes, they're very common, especially in suburban areas where you have a lot of grassy turf type areas and lawns and things like that, in addition to landscaping, vegetation, plants, vegetable gardens, all of that. They're also very common out in the agricultural landscapes because of that tilled soil. But there's also a lot of good vegetation to eat in those agricultural landscapes as well. So they're very common, and they're native to Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Well, my woodchuck is named Justin.
Ah.
And my dog, Seamus, is having a fit because Justin is living under my porch and digging monster holes. Do I have anything to be really concerned about with him there?
Yeah.
I mean, I have a – it's – brick and stone.
Yep.
So I don't have to worry about that. But what
yeah,
do we
so
about?
Groundhogs, as they start digging around your foundation of your buildings, especially your house and things like that, is that it could lead to some flooding or to some water seeping into your basement, depending on how your basement walls are treated with impermeable some kind of a solution or paint or whatever the case might be. If groundhogs are burrowing under your sidewalk or your driveway. Because they're excavating that soil, you could have a collapse of the soil of the sidewalk or driveway in that area. You know, people are concerned about the holes in their yard just because they're unsightly. If you're out in ag landscapes, for example, your livestock, horses might fall into that hole and break a leg. Tractors have certainly fallen into and collapsed the burrows and broken axles and things like that. So there are, you know, people are concerned about it. They're not an aggressive animal, so you don't have to worry about that at all. But they certainly can do damage to your landscaping and agricultural crops in terms of consumption of plant material and things like that. So,
I'm going to keep an eye on him or her.
I was just going to say, it could be Justine, too.
Right.
And I don't know if you saw any young ones.
I did not.
I would be careful about the dog getting access, especially if your dog is one that might try to grab the groundhog, because they're rodent. They've got huge incisors, and they're going to bite.
Good,
back.
Good point. Yeah. Yep. I think it's a young one. It's not very big. So.
Yep. And we should say that there are, again, a pretty decent range of management options to manage groundhogs. And so we've got a series of fact sheets if people want to go and see what they can do for that, including you, Jill. So, but if you go to wildlifedamage.wisc, the first four letters of Wisconsin.edu, you can find a host of fact sheets there that are species specific and will help you manage some of those situations.
So I should print them out and give them to Justin.
Yes, exactly. Or Seamus.
Okay, another email. Matt in the Western UP of Michigan emailed to say that they have seen white-tailed deer fawns born later each year. And he's wondering if that is because of winter arriving later and earlier springs. Is climate change affecting the deer population?
You know, I don't know if we have that answer, but I would say it's, you know, the breeding season is probably more a result of daylight and certainly rutting activity. And certainly does can go through a second estrus cycle. So if they're not bred the first time, they can go through another cycle. And so it's not uncommon to see young fawns or even see fawns. I can remember seeing spotted deer, young deer, during the early deer hunting season in November. So probably not super uncommon, whether that's trending in one direction or another, I'm not sure.
Okay. One of the things we want to talk about is the solar farm proposal that's going to be built in Portage County. You guys, tell me, how's that going to affect wildlife?
I don't think they know yet. So, so there's a solar farm proposal. Apparently, it's going to be the largest. If it's installed, it'll be the largest solar farm in Wisconsin, I believe. And it's going to be around the Buena Vista grassland region, and that's why this is of concern, is because the Buena Vista grassland region is the largest grassland that houses or contains the greater prairie chicken, which is a protected species in the state of Wisconsin. So there's concern about that. Solar energy is increasing, not only in Wisconsin, but in the United States right now as a renewable energy source. And so this is a really interesting conundrum between balancing societal needs in terms of trying to cut back on combustible energy sources like gas and coal and things like that, and increase renewable energy. The issue with solar farms is they take up a lot of space, and this I think is going to occupy over 7,000 acres of land. I believe it's all on private leased land, so Buena Vista is all public, but those prairie chickens do come off of Buena Vista onto private agricultural lands if that habitat, if the agricultural landscape is conducive to hold them, and sometimes it is. So I think that the concern is more about because you're taking all of this land out of production or out of some type of a production, be it wildlife habitat, agricultural production, whatever the case might be, and put it into solar farm, what's the impact or potential impact? And so I don't think anybody knows right now. There's an environmental impact statement that is in the process, and that should shed more light on what's happening here, but no pun intended. But there are other places around the country where solar farms have been put in, and there's some study now in the literature about how that impacts wildlife, and the impacts are kind of a mixed bag. So again, because you're taking land out of some kind of production, again, for wildlife habitat or whatever the case might be, and putting solar panels there and all the infrastructure to support those solar panels, that does have an impact on some species, but other species it doesn't. So it really depends on what the animal is that we're talking about.
So is all the vegetation and stuff under these panels taken away?
Or? Typically it is, because you don't, if it grows up above the panel, you're blocking the sunlight reaching the panel, and you're reducing the amount of energy consumption or energy production, I should say, from that panel. So in addition to, if you have the vegetation, then you have rodents and things like that. And most of the infrastructure is buried at these solar panel farms, but there is exposed wiring and things like that, and rodents will start chewing on that, and so that's not good for the solar panel or production of energy as well. And so a lot of times they'll clear the vegetation not only to prohibit or prevent the reduction of light coming or sunlight coming onto the panel, but also to reduce the amount of wildlife that are in the immediate area. And most of these wind farms are also fenced out or fenced off.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that makes sense.
Which is another area that there, you know, we needs to be thought about. Yep. Is the fencing. It's a couple miles of fence and 8 foot high, you know, that that can have impacts on wildlife movement, not necessarily for birds that can fly in and out, but for other mammals and so on.
For sure.
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of parking lots that would be happy to have those solar panels.
Yeah.
Provide a little shade for my poor little car.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things to consider.
Yep.
For
sure. Absolutely.
So,
but it's a good example of, you know, trying to balance societal needs.
That's right.
Yep. Yep, absolutely. It's all a balancing act. So thanks for the update. Mary emailed to say that their son in Colfax, in the Colfax area, recently got a picture of a cougar with a cub on their game camera. And should he report this to the DNR?
100%. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
We could feel the excitement here in the studio, Mary.
Yeah. So, so if you could just go to the Department of Natural Resources website, they will have a tab for staff contacts or a directory, and you should be able to search by county and either call your local county office, or you can further dive into that and call the local biologist. But yeah, they would be interested in knowing that, and certainly seeing that photograph, and then they can further analyze it, maybe do a site visit, and see what they can learn from it.
Yeah, pretty exciting. Thanks for that email. So I hate to say it, but, you know, fall migration is coming up pretty darn soon. What species are starting?
Yeah, you can kind of feel it in the air. We were talking on our walk over. I mean, the humidity has really dropped. And, there are some early signs, it won't be too long, and we will have some hawks migrating. I think one of them, for me, the other species that kind of signifies, okay, it's the end of the summer, we're starting that migration, is the nighthawks. And I'm out in kind of an agricultural open landscape, so having bonfires and starting to see them moving through is always kind of a big sign for me.
Yeah, and you just mentioned earlier about the dragonflies you're seeing. Yeah. Well, the nighthawks will come and eat the dragonflies. So a lot of times when you see the dragonflies, look up and you'll see these nighthawks flying around. And
even during the day?
Usually like late dusk. Afternoon, yes. Dusk. Yeah.
Okay. This was dusky.
Yep. So that's pretty cool. I just saw a bunch of sandhill cranes kind of flocking up in an ag field this morning, and they are typically a later migratory. They're one of the last birds to migrate out of our area.
And the first to come back.
Yeah, first to come back. But the fact that they're starting to gather is a sign. Bats, we have 8 species of bats in the state of Wisconsin. 4 of them migrate out of our state, and so they'll start migrating probably in another week or so. They'll be gone. Those 4 species will be gone. But then, with the warblers, waterfowl, here in the southern part of the state, come September, October for sure, we'll start seeing loons on some of our lakes here, which is not something that we normally see. We'll see trumpeter swans down in the southern part of the state as they start flying through, which is pretty cool. And so, it's that time of year is coming.
It is. I always look at the color of the green. So the green is a very, blue-green in the spring, and then it starts yellowing out.
Yep. Little duller.
A little more yellow. And I did see some leaves changing last weekend when I was out and about.
Yeah,
so,
we saw some leaves dropping off cottonwood trees for some reason already, so it's kind of funny.
I don't know if the heat is affecting that. I don't know a lot about that. Physiology.
There's so much that can be affected by it. So, one of the things that's been in the news recently is the sandhill crane population that you were talking about. Sandhill cranes have become a concern from a lot of different areas. So, why don't you talk about a little bit about number one, why we have so many of them, and what are the concerns of having so many?
Yeah, so sandhill cranes, if you haven't ever seen a sandhill crane, they're one of the largest birds we have in the state of Wisconsin in terms of height. They're typically generally grayish or grayish, kind of reddish. They have a red cap on their head. And again, they're one of the later migratory birds to leave our state. They're one of the earlier ones to come back, hang out in ag fields and wetlands, marshes, things like that. They're super cool birds, and we've got 2 crane species in the state of Wisconsin. So we have the sandhill crane, which is very common, and we have the whooping crane, which is an endangered, federally endangered species. The whooping crane is all white, also has a kind of a red cap to its head. And when you see the whooping cranes flying overhead, you'll see this very large white kind of pterodactyl-shaped bird with black wingtips. And they're not easy to miss because they're so large. And a lot of times with the sandhill cranes, you hear them. And I'm not going to do that call neither one of you appreciated my previous call.
They bugle.
Bugle.
I just love that sound.
Yeah, so super interesting. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we are in part of the eastern migration or eastern population of the sandhill cranes, and there's a number of subspecies, but we're in the eastern population that takes up Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Ontario, and then these birds will migrate down into Alabama, Texas, areas like that. Over the last few years, there's been an increase in cranes, primarily because of protection, also good habitat. There's been almost a 20% increase since 2022. I think there's an estimated 110,000 cranes in the eastern population. And with that increasing bird crane population, the primary issue is that they will get into agricultural fields and they'll start eating ag crops, especially as corn's starting to come up in the germ phase or, starting to germinate. They'll just walk down the row and just pull those seeds out of the ground. And so that is a big issue. There are some strategies to combat crane depredation or crane damage to corn crops in particular. One of them is coating your corn seeds with this product called Avapel, which is like a crane repellent prior to planting it. But that requires extra money, extra time, extra labor, things like that. And so currently there's a legislative committee through the Wisconsin State Legislature that is starting to examine a potential crane harvest season or having a crane hunt. And this was looked at again in 2021, and it didn't come to fruition at that time. I'm not sure there's great public support for a crane population or a crane hunt in the state of Wisconsin. There are crane harvests in other states, for example, Nebraska and Alabama and some other places like that. But here in Wisconsin, we don't seem to have public support for that. But they're going to start looking at a crane hunt again and see if that would be another way to alleviate some of the ag damage that, that farmers are seeing. Interestingly, we're seeing cranes more and more in urban areas. So they are becoming an urban adapted species. And we'll get reports occasionally where people are having cranes pecking on their windows or their glass doors because the crane sees the reflection and sees a potential competitor and are trying to get that bird out of the area, not realizing they're looking at themselves. So that's an issue. And then people are sometimes alarmed just because the animal's in their yard and is poking holes in the grass, you know, because they eat invertebrates and soil insects and things like that. But the damage that cranes do in urban areas is really pretty superficial and really minimal.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Did you have any comments on that,
Jamie? Yeah, I was just, so there's the legislative study committee that mm-hmm. David mentioned. So there's both Republican and Democratic legislators on that committee, but in addition, a number of the stakeholder groups have representatives. So, the Corn Growers Association, the Potato and Vegetable Growers Association, the International Crane Foundation, mm-hmm. right here in Baraboo, has representation, as well as the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association and Delta Waterfowl. So, you know, their charge is to come up with recommendations on how to manage the growing sandhill crane population and address the wildlife damage. And certainly, you know, whether you're a hunter, mm-hmm. a non-hunter, conservationist, you know, there are different viewpoints on how you see this. On one side, you know, the crane's life history is different than some of the game birds that we've been talking about in terms of how many young they have. They don't start breeding until they're 4 years old. They're essentially mate for life unless that bond has been broken. Have two young, often maybe only one survives. So it takes a while to replace themselves. On the other hand, you know, we're the largest breeding state for the eastern population of sandhill cranes. So our farmers have the greatest impacts across the flyway. We do have other states who are harvesting through permits, regulated hunting, a number of those cranes. Right now, the state is able to issue ag damage permits to farmers. And there, you know, we are killing 1,000 sandhill cranes each year right now as it is, and they're not able to utilize that resource. So a hunting season could potentially allow us to then utilize. They are good table fare and often eaten in other states that do harvest cranes.
Another thing I'll just mention, mm-hmm. if you don't mind me jumping in. So we have a program in Wisconsin called the Wisconsin Damage Abatement and Claims Program that's run through the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources that helps farmers offset damage to their egg crops from wildlife species and select wildlife species. So right now, deer, bear, Canada geese, and turkey, you're eligible for not only help with managing those species, but also economic compensation for the damage. Sandhill cranes are one of the species that you could get compensated for, but only if there's a harvest season that's in place. And since there's no harvest season, there's no economic compensation or any technical support for managing crane damage in agricultural areas. And the last thing I'll just mention is one of the things that also is holding up the crane hunt or is a concern if we have a crane hunt here in the state of Wisconsin is the confusion about potentially shooting an endangered whooping crane versus a more common sandhill crane. And so...
It is complicated. Well, thank you for giving us some of those facts, so at least we're informed. David and Jamie, thank you so much for being with us today. David Drake is a UW Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor, and Jamie Knack is a UW Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. Stay with us, where we've got a really great guest coming up talking about restoring a prairie. So stay with us.
in 2009, there was an idea to create a safe route between an elementary school and a public library in the small village of Eagle. And what grew out of that idea was a tallgrass prairie, an oak savanna, and a wetland restoration project. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau. This is the Larry Mueller Show. And here with us to tell this story is Lori Lawler. She's the author of the new book called Restoring Prairie Woods and Pond, How a Small Trail Can Make a Big Difference. And the book really celebrates the often thankless work of volunteers to restore habitat, connect neighborhoods, and, you know, maybe link the past to the future a little bit. Is there a nature trail like this in your community that you're grateful for? Or do you live near a neglected and overgrown lot that you like to do something about? Well, maybe we'll have a little advice for you on how to restore that habitat or maybe build a trail. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Lori, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you. It's wonderful to be here again.
I was telling you before, this is such a nice book, and it's not huge. It's got beautiful pictures. Did you write it for a specific audience?
That's a great question. It's really designed to appeal to readers from about age 10 to 99. I kind of think
that's
of it that
small
way.
Range.
A small range. And I think it's because of the subject matter and one of the big questions that has always intrigued me. What can we do to help save the planet? Mm-hmm. And so the appeal has been much broader than I had imagined. And I think in a lot of ways, it's a very much a people story. Because I've been contacted by folks from Northern Ohio, California, other parts of Wisconsin, Illinois, kind of asking, you know, what can I do in my community? And because it's a small project, it's you can put your arms around it.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And it didn't cost a whole bunch of money.
No, no. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the big challenge because Eagle has had a lot of money problems over the years. And it required some big convincing of a large group of people. And I think what's really wonderful is it's a very bare bones budget. It's only 8 acres.
Mm-hmm.
It was truly, truly a mess, as you mentioned. It was abandoned for years. It was filled with garbage and it was a safety issue. So that was kind of what catalyzed the town to sort of think, how can we create something between the school and the library that will be safe for kids to travel?
Yeah, and it must have been something that helped was the fact that you could see the difference quickly because it is only 8 acres.
Right, right. And I think that is really essential for a lot of folks interested in doing restoration.
Mm-hmm.
In Europe, they call it rewilding, but here we call it restoration. And I think that it's also less of a horrible challenge, I think, for people to think, well, how can we keep doing this? Because, as you say, the big work of clearing and coming up with an idea and coming in with these wonderful native plants, but then it's the years and years afterward of keeping that going.
Sure.
And so I think it's a project that is inspiring for that reason.
Mm-hmm. And I can see so many people right now thinking, oh yeah, we've got that area in our area, you know, in our community that we would really love to clean up. And you've been able to utilize, not just clean it up, but it's a teaching area too.
Right. And I think that's what really drew me to this idea.
Mm-hmm.
Because the kids from Eagle Elementary use it as an outdoor classroom. And so they use it all year long, even in the winter. The library lends snowshoes, which is really kind of fun. And they go out and they do readings, they do paintings, they do a lot of artwork. They also do a lot of science and STEM study outdoors. So it's also what I think was really true when I was working on the book during COVID was how much people really discovered, like, this is a terrific place to find peace, sort of rejuvenate, just be outside. Very easy to access. And I think that that's another reason these small projects can have enormous impact.
Well, let's talk about this small project. Yeah. How did it start? What was the seed?
Well, the seed of it was what started out as a safety issue. And I think what was really key, though, there was a small group of local nature lovers who kind of decided to dream big. And they rallied the community to renovate and to restore this area based on what was kind of an interesting experience. There was a small group of people who went out into this horrible mess, right? Fought their way through, and they started making these amazing discoveries. You know, they found purple coneflower, which is a prairie plant. They found other evidence that something else had been in this place before buckthorn and sumac took over. And what's interesting, the story that really drew me in was these three people went out to look, kind of do a plant inventory, basically. And as they got through, they were kind of walking through the garbage and all this stuff that was there. And suddenly they heard frog song. And it was like no one knew. There was this little tiny ephemeral pond, which... For those folks who, you know, you probably have seen these, they're kind of like they come and go. Like now during this part of the summer when it gets really hot, they disappear. But it's a great place for frogs because there's no fish.
Right. No predators.
No predators. So it was this discovery of the pond that kind of motivated the committee to think bigger and to think we could do three remarkable ecosystems that are interrelated. And the prairie part also was very interesting because of the forensic environmental detective work that was done. They realized that this part of Waukesha County was originally one of the biggest prairies in southeastern Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And so looking at old maps, they figured it out. And again, that's something I think folks can do in their communities. Like, what was here before?
Right.
You know, what's buried?
Mm-hmm.
What's underneath the soil that we can possibly tap into?
Yeah. We've got so much technology at our fingertips these days that that's pretty plausible.
Yeah, exactly. So that, I love to do research. So that was one of the things that I really enjoyed trying to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
What was here before? Looking at aerial photographs, looking at old settler notes, looking at all kinds of surveyor notebooks, and just finding out what was there. So the plan grew and grew and grew, and luckily they found enough people who were motivated to help and to work on the project. And they got a lot of donations from Builder Square. Different groups came in and donated seed. Agricol donated seed. So again, you know, it's possible with the right outreach that small community groups can do the same. And I think that that's really significant.
One of the quotes you had in your book, and I can't remember now who said it, but they're talking about getting people to come in and help that necessarily aren't interested in restoring the actual thing, but there's connections. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, and that was one of the early organizers. His name was David Traver, and he had a really interesting thought, which I think is applicable today, too. He said, a frontal attack on people about nature doesn't really help.
It's so true.
You know, like making people feel bad or guilty or whatever. His approach was really interesting. He loved tractors. And so he had a tractor and he would approach someone. And he would say, you know, they'd start talking about engines. And he would start asking them, well, what kind of tractor do you have? Or what kind of, you know, engine work do you do? And it was that personal relationship. He said, well, come over and help us. We're bulldozing this area. We're trying to grade this area. And they came because of the personal relationship with him. And I think building those relationships with people in a community, it really made the huge difference.
So let's go back a little bit now. So you've got the people that have gone out, found the frog, got all excited. What happened next?
The next, well, they had to first convince the committee.
Okay.
And then convince enough people, because people also realized at that point that this was going to take a lot of boots on the ground.
Sure.
Effort. And so they had to work with trying to find people who had the expertise, but also really wanted to help. So I think what's amazing is they had Boy Scouts, they had teachers, they had firemen, they had all different kinds of folks from the community come out and help. And I think organizing those people and getting them involved was that was a huge effort. But at the same time I'm saying that, I think what I've really noticed as being part of this group more recently, it's fun. And
yes.
And I think that that's something we sometimes forget. Like, it's actually fun to, you know, to dig around in the dirt. And I think especially during COVID, going out, digging, raking, pulling out invasive species, whether you're a grown up or a kid, was really a way to alleviate despair.
Mm-hmm. And a sense of accomplishment.
Yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
Right.
And working together. So it's got, I think there's hidden benefits mm-hmm. to this kind of work.
For sure. We're talking to Lori Lawler. She's the author of the new book, Restoring Prairie, Woods, and Pond, How a Small Trail Can Make a Big Difference. The book is about how the residents of the village of Eagle built a trail and restored vital natural habitat. We'd love you to join the conversation. Our number is 800-642-1234, or you can email us, talk@WPR.org. Well, I hope you can join us again tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show. We get home improvement and advice on how to get water out of our homes and maybe keep it from going in the first place. And then we'll get a reminder about how to stay safe while boating. That's tomorrow starting at 11 right here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now we are talking about a great grassroots effort in getting a cool trail established in Eagle, Wisconsin. We got to the point where we've got people excited. You've got permission from the city or the township, I'm assuming.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. And actually, excuse me, what was really helpful was Dave Traver, who was very involved in the beginning, was an attorney. So he was able to go in and talk to the city and basically said, and this is another thing that folks might consider, we'll do this for free. You don't have, the city doesn't have to give us any money.
That's always helpful.
Yes. And it's a safety issue, which of course cities also love, right? So I think it was kind of a win-win in that regard, mm-hmm. You know, that they could get the people involved and accomplish something with very little cost. So I think that was really, really important. And I also think one other thing that's a kind of a common misperception about these projects is that you have to be an expert. You have to be a landscape designer. You have to have all these, special degrees. They were able to, it's often true that you can get folks to volunteer their services if they have a professional expertise in a certain area. But at the same time, what this particular project relied on was wonderful support. And I think Wisconsin has amazing groups. And one of them is the Wisconsin Wetland Association. There's a lot of information, advice through the Prairie Enthusiast, Wild Ones. There's just a lot of organizations that don't require big fees. Volunteers will come out, take a look at the property, kind of give you suggestions. What are some native plants that will work?
That's so important because you don't want to waste money and time putting things in that really don't belong there.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So that was really kind of an interesting aspect to the whole thing.
Uh-huh. How long did it take?
It took a long time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think they started in 2009. They, they graded it. They got the new plants in. They had to cut down a lot of buckthorn, which folks know is very...
Oh, it's terrible.
It's impossible. And they got the new plants in, and they encountered some really big challenges. You know, there were years of drought where they were really worried that some of the prairie plants that they had seeded wouldn't come up. And luckily, they realized over time, and I think this is a learning experience, they realized that the prairie plants can survive drought. Then there were other years where there were terrific rains and something like what we've had here in the spring. and the pond overflowed and went all over the place. And so they had frogs. I think this is such a great story. The frogs were so loud, so numerous, and they were trying to get into the library.
I love that story, too. I thought that was so funny.
And it's just, I think one of the other things is sort of our ability to roll with punches. Like, nature is sometimes messy, right?
It is all the time messy.
But also a big adventure. And I think that was what the group learned. And, mm-hmm. and each year they have learned new things, mm-hmm. how to engage high school students, how to engage college kids who are doing community service. And there's just a lot of folks out there who want to help. Mm-hmm. And how do you connect them in a meaningful way so they'll come back?
And that seems to be the case, because obviously this has been going on for quite a long time now, and it's still being renovated.
And I think that's an ongoing project. Yeah. Everybody who knows, anyone who started a prairie knows it's wonderful, but you have to have someone come in and help you do a burn. Mm-hmm. Or when you put in new plants, you have to be aware of, like, where can they actually thrive? So they've learned a lot over the years, but I think it's just a wonderful place to visit.
Mm-hmm. Have you had the case where when this started, there were some probably kids in that elementary school or now adults? Are they coming back to help?
Yes. And I think that's Gene Weedman, who is a really amazing local person from Eagle, who's a retired teacher, has basically said that. excuse me, as a teacher herself, she said, you work with kids, you get them out and they get muddy. They dig holes, they water things. But you never know, like, what is the impact until much later. Mm-hmm. So I think that's been a driving force. Like, how has this project perhaps changed the lives, the attitudes of kids as they grow older? Because that's the next generation who will work to save the planet.
Yeah.
So I think their experience, their love of what they've accomplished, will
sure.
help.
And not only the nature, but the evidence of a community working together, the cooperation, that's got to be lasting also.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. While I was there one day, a little girl came who had planted a small plant, a cardinal flower, and she arrived and she looked really distraught and she was like, "Where's my plant?" It was like that ownership, right? Well, we showed her where it was, but she really, it's like she was invested because she had planted this cardinal mm-hmm. flower and she wanted to know how was it doing.
Sure. Yeah. That's a great way to get kids to eat vegetables, right? Make them plant them, then they'll want to eat them. So getting back to this book, like I said, it's really, really a good read. It's thin, so it won't take you forever. But I love the section where you go all the way back to the Ice Age.
Yeah.
And it's like a picture of what happened in kind of like, fast time. But it's so interesting.
Yeah.
Did you have to do a lot of investigation on that?
Yes. And I actually love doing research. The hard part for me is doing the writing.
If
I could just do the research, I would just keep doing it. But here at the university, there's wonderful resources looking at some of those early, early years.
Mm-hmm.
What I found to be really fascinating were the aerial photographs that were taken about 1937, looking at farm fields.
Sure.
And so you can kind of watch this piece of land change,
mm-hmm.
and it becomes more and more overgrown. And you watch it even through the Depression. And I think it really it was very visual for me to kind of imagine what it might have been like to be in this one spot over a period of thousands of years. And what was also really intriguing was the discovery I made of a person I interviewed who was the niece of the woman who actually owned the land. And it was very fascinating because it was a very personal story.
Sure.
Of how this woman's brother had been killed during World War II. He had amassed some money as a soldier, gave it to Agnes, and Agnes kept it. And then she bought this piece of land. So there's sort of this interesting story of generosity and sacrifice, I
yes,
think, too.
Yes, perfect. We do have a caller, Barry in Richland Center. Go ahead, Barry.
Good afternoon. I got a couple of questions that I'd like to ask. One, you mentioned that you had graded the landscape after cutting the buckthorn, et cetera. What other sorts of preparations did you go through? I'm involved in starting a prairie, and I'm wondering how you handled the residual weed seeds that must have been still in the ground, and how you're managing the weeds in the prairie now.
Thank you for your question. That's a wonderful question, and good luck to you. That sounds like a terrific project. They had to pull a lot of stumps, so there was stump pulling that was going on to kind of level it. What they did was they used prairie grass seed. They seeded it. And over the years, they've also been burning. So that has helped with the weed control. And I think the whole... The amount of time it takes, right, to create a prairie, we have to be so patient. And I think that that's the one thing, another wonderful aspect to the project that I've been able to see. So I think now when we go out and look at the prairie at Eagle Nature Trail, it is just abundance of flowers. But it wasn't like that. And so you have to kind of wait and wait. And I know that's hard. It's hard to do. But they did, you know, they hung in there. And I think fire is a huge part of it.
It's definitely key. And Barry, we do have a prairie expert coming on Garden Talk on Friday, August 30th. So Neil DeBoll will be with us. So if you've got any questions about that, please give us another call so we can go further into that with our expert there. So thanks for calling. Yeah. So right now, everybody can use it, right? It's not just...
Absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely. So people walking their dogs, riding their bikes. There's a photography contest, so a lot of people show up with their cameras, their cell phones. They take pictures of bees, sandhill cranes, mm-hmm. whoever's visiting. And I think that's the real beauty of the place that people are noticing over the seasons. The installation of so many wonderful native plants has brought back... native insects, native birds, native amphibians. And I think that has created a lot of interest in the community, and people come back to see, well, what's there now? Mm-hmm. You know, it's constantly changing.
Have that brought people into the community that don't live there to see this?
Yeah, actually, a couple folks, and I was going to invite people to come and visit.
Yes.
Yeah, please come. I've had a couple folks from the Chicago area specifically come up. So they're eco-tourists.
Sure.
In Eagle, which is wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got to be good for the restaurants in town and the gas stations and everything else. So, and you're really close to Old World Wisconsin, too.
Right.
So that's maybe you have a little bit of a spillover there.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And
the
Kettle Moraine State Forest, which is just splendid, too.
Yes.
So that's another.
It's beautiful. It is a beautiful part of the state. So that helps, too. Now, over the years, you've added some things to the initial trail, too, right?
Yes. So the trail now has like a little woodland walk, which is kind of another little which was very fun to put in. They've included a boardwalk out into the wetland area so people can go out and look at the little pond when it's full.
Mm-hmm.
And so every year things start changing. And I think, again, that's what's so wonderful about this kind of project. It changes depending on suggestions, what people are interested in, and then as they come and visit, what do they notice? What's different?
Uh-huh.
I think that's great.
Yeah, that is great. And then getting back to your book now. So again, it's Restoring Prairie Woods and Pond. Where can people get this?
You can get it at any independent bookstore. Actually, the paperback version of it just came out this week.
Perfect.
So that's really terrific.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's available through independent bookstores, through Amazon, through the publisher themselves, which is Holiday House in New York.
Yeah. And one thing, too, as we didn't talk about, is that you've divided into seasons in the back, so you can kind of see what it looks like in the different seasons. So that's great, too. So, Lori, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. I enjoyed speaking with you. And again, good luck to folks trying out this kind of community work. It's really fun.
Absolutely.
And I really encourage people to give it a try.
Okay, great. Well, thank you again for being with us. We're talking to Lori Lawler. She's the author of several books, including Rachel Carson and her book that changed the world. So check that one out. She's actually living here in southern Wisconsin. So join us again tomorrow, the Larry Mueller Show. This and all our shows are, of course, a team effort. I want to thank our producers, Claire Neipert, Joel Patnaud, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, our technical directors. I'm the executive director, Jill Nadeau. And of course, Larry Mueller is our host. Stay well.